Imagine me and you, I do. I think about you day and night. It's only right to think about the girl you love and hold her tight. So happy together. If I should call you up.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. On the line, all the way from sunny Charlotte, North Carolina, my good friend, Professor Bob Harvey. Professor Harvey, how are you and the family doing?
We're doing well. How's your family doing?
Doing fine, man. It's been a while, and I think you must have your radio on.
I want to turn the speaker. No, I just said the speaker was on.
Oh, you were on the speakerphone.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Okay. So, Professor Harvey, man, you are one of the most brilliant men that I know, and it's true. And, you know, you're as a historian, man, you are one of the top historians, definitely. And I just wanted to begin with, your wife has a PhD, you a professor, your children, very well educated. Education has been right at the top with you and your family. That's what you guys do. That's what you guys are. What is your thought about President Biden for giving, you know, at a maximum $20,000 for families, for people who $125,000 or under, or $40,000 for families, you know, $250,000 joint families, $250,000, and that forgiveness. What is your thought? I think you're in a better position with all the education that your family has. Is he making a mistake?
No, Errol, because it's an investment. I mean, you know, we look at the money that we spend now from kindergarten all the way up through to, you know, 3 years of kindergarten, pretty much, all the way up through to the 12th grade. I mean, that's 15 years of public education. Now, what we've tried to do in some degrees is to privatize some of it, but it's an investment. You know, one of the greatest inventions of Western civilization, and especially the United States, is the fact that we can guarantee every child an opportunity to get an education from K three or K2 or whatever, all the way up through to the 12th grade. We're one of the few civilizations in world history that's ever attempted to do that type. In fact, it's the only one that I know of. Now, there are others that will get you up to a certain level, like the 7th or 8th grade, and then you have to take a test to see what your performances are, and then you move on to something else.
Right.
But in the United States of America, one of its greatest gifts, and that was formulated pretty much in the late 18th century, once the United States was formulated, was to get universal education, for, you know, for everyone, and to promise for that. And that's what has been a cornerstone of what has made this country great. You know, and now to see it under assault, and it's pretty much been under assault since the Brown versus Board of Education decision came along in 1954, and then the subsequent second Brown decision in 55. And then in 56, 101 Southern politicians got together and agreed to resist integration at all costs. And they resisted all the way up through. When I graduated from high school in 1965, 11 years after the Brown decision, we were still in the segregated system here in North Carolina, and I went to the Burlington City School System, and we were still segregated. So they did resist at all costs, and they held on as long as they could. And when they decided to go ahead and integrate by force and by they didn't have a choice. What they did is they started setting up their own schools. You see, what we went through in Milwaukee a few years ago with the Charleston charter schools popping up all over the place, we tried that down south early and it didn't work. You know why? Because the dynamics and the cost were just so prohibitive that, you know, those families, those white families that pulled out of the public school system, set up their own academy. Some of them built whole brand-new academies. Within 4 to 5 years, Earl, many of those schools had to shut down. Ran out of kids, and they ran out of money. And so what they ended up doing was creating a lot of these new mega schools in white communities and busing black kids in to get the numbers that they needed. And that's the same dynamic that they did in North Carolina in the late 1960s and 1970s. We saw that same transition going on in Milwaukee in the 80s and 90s. I mean, just look at it. When they had that referendum in 96 to build or renovate 18 schools, you know, they got all kind of resistance. In that referendum, of the 16 automatic districts, only 5 of them voted for the referendum. And of those 5, they were all headed by African-American politicians. And, of course, Paul Henningsen's district, which was the 4th. All of the others, they voted against it. And so race played a major part in that. And it's funny that everybody's talking about the Central City schools failing. What's amazing about that is most of the teachers that are teaching in the Central City schools are white. They're white. Not only that, but the public schools in the suburbs and in the rural areas, they're not failing. They may be struggling under the issue of cost, but they're not failing. So there's been a deliberate assault on public education, mainly looking at it through the eyes of the Central City School, where you have a large collection of minorities. So what's happening here, Earl, is racialization of education. And now with the new Charleston charter schools taking off all over the place, then what we find is that public education is now under assault. It is under assault. And when that happens, it is not only going to impact what we do at the elementary and secondary level, but it's going to also impact on going off to college. And it's becoming more and more expensive. So my thing is that we reinvest in education at all levels and make it easier for kids to go off to college, Earl, because going off to college is one avenue. It's not the only avenue, but it's one avenue that will allow us to achieve the American middle-class dream. Earl, that is the whole key, and education is one of those. I remember in the service, we used to start off every morning going through basic and AIT training down at the Infantry School of Fort Benning. We would always say, education is the key, graduation's up to me. Even there, they emphasized the importance of education. And it's education, education. So if we have to give a financial, you know, a break or incentive to go off to college, it's not meant for everybody, then so be it, do it. We give billions of dollars for war. We just spent in excess of almost $1 trillion over the last 10 years developing the F-35 Lightning, which is a stealth attack plane. We spend almost $8 billion to build the new Gerald Ford class aircraft carrier. That's without the planes or the crew, just building the ship. $7 to $8 billion. That's on the prototype. There are at least 10 more coming down, 9 more coming down the pike over the next 40 years for an aircraft carrier. And we don't mind spending that money for war. But we can't spend more money to forgive an educational system that's out of whack. The big mistake was when Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, passed legislation over the last 30 years to let private institutions, financial institutions, take over the financing of public of the college educational loan system. They going to make, they got to make their profits up front.
Right.
And that's what they have done. So, yes, we need to invest in it, and a forgiveness loan for that situation is one thing, but we need to reform the whole system. These colleges with these huge endowments and trusts, they need to stop increasing the tuition of students. They need to stop doing it. When I went to school, Earl, we only paid just a small amount of money, you know, every year to go to special events. Now, parents are having to come up with all kinds of money, even in high school, in an elementary school, all kinds of fees for their kids to go to school. It should be free for all kids.
You know, Professor Harvey, Jeannie Pirro from Fox News was on yesterday, and she blasted the student debt relief. She says we shouldn't be giving this debt relief. My family paid for my education.
If she's rich, yeah.
No,
you know, in our case.
But my point, Professor Harvey, is so yeah, she was born rich. I mean, her family was able to pay her way. She was a judge, so they paid her way through law school. They paid her way through everything. And she's talking about we shouldn't be forgiving. We shouldn't be forgiving the loans because she was born with a gold spoon in her mouth.
Well, see, Earl, I can say one of the problems with this whole process is that it's been racialized. John Hope Franklin, in Chapter 10 of his seventh edition, wrote a classic. There was a chapter entitled Philanthropy and Self-Help. I think it was Chapter 10 in his earlier books. That went From Slavery to Freedom went through about 10 editions. But in the seventh edition, there's a chapter called Philanthropy and Self-Help, in which he gave a historical rundown of black education, especially in the Jim Crow South. If you remember, in the South, it was against the law in every southern state for blacks to be taught to read and write. And once slavery ended in 1865, they finally managed to make black citizens. One of the first things that happened is that a lot of white philanthropists, white, what they call carpetbaggers, and white educators came down south, and some whites in the South, they got together with black ministers and the whole bit, and they started setting up schools. And to keep the situation segregated, whites set up, you know.
A winter's day in a deep and dark December.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You text us at that same number on the line, all the way from sunny Charlotte, North Carolina. My good friend, Professor Bob Harvey. You know, Professor Harvey, and if you are looking at this thing as you are, again, coming from, a family that is very well educated, and you know the impact that education has had in your family's life, with your wife having a PhD, you being a professor, your children very well educated. You know, there are people who especially have taken out Pell Grants, Professor Harvey. It's different in this country for people who have and who have not. And education is more expensive than it should ever be, Professor Harvey. You know, you can look at other nations across the earth, developed nations, and education through college is, you know, they want to make sure that their people are educated, so they do everything within their power not to strap them with this horrific debt. Shouldn't you want your society to be educated, Professor Harvey?
Well, Earl, Carl, you know, let me just use my own personal analysis on this. When I went to school at North Carolina Central in Durham from 65 until I graduated in 70 with the bachelor's degree, and then went on to grad school from 71 to 73, there was an economic phenomenon that allowed me to do it, and that was that during the summer, Earl, I worked at a textile factory right there in Burlington, North Carolina, and made enough money working the third shift. And sometimes in August, when just before getting ready to go to school, I'd work a double shift. And I saved up enough money for my tuition at the time to be able to do it. And by the time I got to the second semester with my dad and them chipping in a little money here, they could all dirt poor, I was able to sustain it. And I got a couple of scholarships on the way to second semester. But I was able to do it. And then when I went on for all the way up through my master's degree, when I got into my master's degree program, I had a graduate fellowship and a teaching assistantship each one of those years. So I was able to pay for my tuition through that. And then when I went to postgraduate school in Madison in 1980, the thing is that that program was expensive, but I had a teaching assistantship. It was called an Advanced Opportunity Fellowship grant. So I was lucky enough to get that. But the thing is that I was also in the Army Reserves. And as long as I was in the active Army Reserves, Uncle Sam paid for it as long as I maintained a C average. Well, hell, you can't stay in a graduate program without at least a B average. So I was good to go there. And Uncle Sam paid 75% of my money funds for that doctoral program. Now, I never finished, but the bottom line is that Uncle Sam paid for it. And that's the other thing, Earl. What we're doing right now is we're making it impossible for kids who even go through the GI Bill to be able to survive and sustain themselves because it's so expensive. Not only that, but the jobs that we used to have to help us pay for education
aren't there anymore.
Good family-sustaining jobs, they're gone. They are gone, and they're not coming back, not anytime soon. So we're making it harder and harder for American children to be able to get a quality education from elementary school, from kindergarten all the way up through to high school, and then right on into college. We're making it impossible for them to get to that next level because, let's face it, with the family-sustaining jobs gone, it means that a kid coming right out of high school with a diploma can't even find a decent family-sustaining job. So we are killing the avenues to the American middle class. And I don't care what the people on Fox News or anyone else says. Our young people now with the opportunities to achieve the American dream of getting to the American middle class, that avenue is closing. And Earl, that's one of the keys to a lot of the problems that we have in this country right now. A lot of the problems we have in this country right now, Earl, and it's not talked about by Fox News or CNN or MSNBC or any of the rest of them, is that the American middle class is dying.
Yes.
And I will continue to say that over and over again because there's not been so many ways you can say it.
But they're blaming.
And once the American middle class goes, our democracy is gone.
You know, Professor Harvey, and yet they're blaming the wrong people. For the fact that this is happening.
That's the whole point. Yes.
You know, they're blaming people from coming in from different countries. They're blaming people who don't have, it's not their issue, it's not their fault. The people who made this all possible, many of them are wealthy, and they've benefited by this. And the redistribution of wealth has taken place, and the middle class wealth has been drained and gone to the wealthy when they led people to believe that they were going to take the wealth from the upper crust and redistribute it to the middle class. It's been the exact opposite, Professor Harvey, that's taken place.
The exact opposite, and sadly, Earl, much of the problem or the blame for this are the very people who are doing most of the complaining right now, because they're saying we shouldn't give it to them. And the simple fact is that you elected people at the city, county, state and federal level that made this possible.
Yes.
You know, it's the same with health insurance. There's no reason why we shouldn't have universal health care for everyone. But the very people who are benefiting from it the most, with the Affordable Care Act and the whole bit, low-income to middle-income white Americans. Yet, they're the ones who voted continuously against, you know, the Affordable Care Act.
Hey, Professor Harvey, hang on. Hang on. Professor Harvey, we got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. On the line, Professor Bob Harvey, all the way from Charlotte, North Carolina. You can join us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789 in Texas at that same number. On the line, Professor Bob Harvey, all the way from sunny Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, Professor Harvey, in addition to all the other things and historic facts and history that you have covered, the Constitution is one that that I always love hearing you talk about, because right now, for people who may not be aware, we're not historians. We've been around a while. We know something is going on in this country, Professor Harvey, that has not many of us have not seen. We know that we are endangered. Right now, there's an internal rot in this nation, Americans who are willing to fight other Americans, the separation. There is no compromise on things from the right. It's either going to be our way, or you know, it's going to be our way. Period. And so we don't care what you Democrats say. It's our turn. Professor Harvey, you've studied the history of this nation and people talking about and the Constitution. How dangerous a time is this, in your estimation?
Well, Earl, if people stop and analyze the Constitution carefully, gone all the way from the First Amendment with the right to petition your government, which basically is the right to vote. And that's in the First Amendment, and then gone all the way up through to the 26th Amendment. You know, 18-year-olds the right to vote. What you have are probably next to civil rights issues. The right to vote is perhaps the most talked about issues and segments of the Constitution of the United States. When you look at the 14th Amendment, which gave African Americans the right to vote, African American men the right to vote in all federal elections, and then of course you still had the 12th Amendment, which dealt with the Electoral College, which is the big thing that's going on right now, and the Republicans are basing all of that on them because they know they don't have the popular, so they're going to go with the Electoral College. Then of course you've got the 15th Amendment, which gave black men the right to vote, 1870, black men the right to vote in all elections. And the reason they came up with the 15th Amendment 2 years after the 14th was because Southern whites were finding ways to deny blacks the right to vote back during that time period. So in the 19th century, they were doing it. And then, of course, you have the 19th Amendment, which passed in 1920, right after World War I, where women got the right to vote. And then, of course, you had the 23rd, which gave people in D.C. the right to vote, and then, of course, you had the 24th Amendment, which conferred and you got rid of the idea of the poll tax that Southern whites were imposing on blacks to vote and all kind of tests that they were throwing out there. So you have this process where the Constitution has constantly tried to adjust to obstructionists denying people the right to vote. The only voice that the people of the United States have is the right to vote. Now, unfortunately, too many of those people of color, and there were too many poor people, those individuals have failed to exercise that right. They did it in the 2020 election. 81 million people voted to get Donald Trump out, but 74 million voted for him. So people are exercising their rights. But there's a story that needs to be told, and of course, many conservative whites have caught on to it, and they know that if they don't deny people the right to vote, that they cannot win the national election. They know that. So they've come up with ways, gerrymandering, which is what almost every state has to go through because of the census. And remember, the Republicans control the 2020 census. They carved up everything that they needed to do so that they could go ahead and impose their will. And they did it at the city, county, and the state level. That's where it took place. And setting up the gerrymandering, and even in some cases, gentrification programs, selecting certain people to live in certain districts so they can control it. All of those things have taken place. So they're undermining the very cornerstone of the American democratic process, the right to vote, and we've already talked about the right of education. Both of those are gone. They're dwindling. They're not completely gone, but they're dwindling. And those are avenues to the middle class. Now, believe it or not, making it harder with the whole issue of absentee ballots, that's been a cornerstone of the conservative movement for ages. And think about this. One of the bedrocks in terms of voting populace for the conservative movement are elderly whites. The number one are white men. Following that are elderly whites and then white women. And here you are, and the elderly people, because America's getting older, and more of those elderly people are unable to stand in those long lines or whatever, they need the absentee ballot. They are denying, in an effort to deny people of color and others the right to vote, they are denying one of the cornerstones to their voting bloc from voting. So they're cutting off their nose to spite their face. It's the same as that, you know, with the Affordable Care Act. They're cutting off their nose to spite their face. And that is the sad dilemma that we are faced with now in this country. We are cutting off the avenues that allow the American people to exercise their right. The greatest right that the American citizen has is the right to vote.
You know, Professor Harvey, you pointed it out so perfectly, and that this, in the long term, their attack of poor people and people of color in the long run, it is going to be a detrimental to more than just poor people and people of color. And once this is gone and taken away, Professor Harvey, it's not going to be able to, you're not going to bring it back. You know, the people.
Well, you know, Earl, it's been taken away before. Remember, you know, these fights that we're having now, the thing that makes them so magnified is the fact that we have these news media, you know, all the way through Twitter and online with Facebook and all this other stuff, and with the news media being the way it is, with satellite TV, 24-hour, you know, news TV. We have exposure now, but Earl, there's always been segments of our society that we've threatened to deny people the right to vote. When you look at what happened at the close of the American Civil War, and remember, the American Civil War was all about an insurrection. It was an armed insurrection that failed. It came close. For 4.5 years, the bloodiest war in American history was the American Civil War. And that's what happened there. People were not pleased with the election, And it was the situation that happened in 1860 was January 6th on steroids. They overthrew government facilities, therefore they overdefiled on the Stars and Stripes. And Robert E. Lee and Longstreet and Jeb Stuart and Jefferson Davis, Austin, all of them attempted to overthrow the government of the United States and create their own territory and their own states. That's the Confederate States of America, 11 states. And in 1860, Earl, there were 16 states that made up the Union. 16 free states and 15 slave states, 31 in all. And of the 15 slave states, four of them, Kentucky, Delaware, Maryland, and Missouri, by military force, stayed in the Union. But the other 11 slave states all seceded from the Union. And for 4.5 years, with a third of the population, they waged total war against the government of the United States. And after 4.5 years of bloody fighting, it was finally overthrown. And the thing that they were fighting for, yes, it was not all about race. A lot of it was about economics. But it was an economics invested in slaves. That's what it comes back to. Their number one product was cotton, and their second most valuable product were slaves. If you look at the economic data from all of the ex-Confederate states, between 1850 all the way up until 1860, but they're doing that 10-year period, you see that's why they call it the cotton, that cotton was king. They call it the cotton kingdom because they made the largest GDP for this country was through cotton. And the third largest was slaves. So what we got to appreciate is that when the slaves were going to be, they weren't going to be taken away. Lincoln didn't want to take the slaves away. He wanted to limit the expansion of slavery. And when Lincoln got in, they didn't like the election results. So they attempted to overthrow the government of the United States. And thus the Civil War was waged.
So, Professor Harvey, there are people who will say, that was then, this is now, there's no way possible for that to ever take place again. You say what to that?
But that's not true. It's just that what's happened now is that they've gone to another level, and they're able to wage war now, not just, you know, through guns, but they're fighting, they're preparing for a race war and a war against the government right now. But the thing is that there's so many more avenues to voice their concerns. Now, keep in mind one of the great ironies of this. This country started off divided. There has always been a hatred of the federal government, Earl. Always been a hatred. Remember, two of the first political parties created in the 18th century when the Union was formed and George Washington became president from 1789 to 1797. When Washington got in, his cabinet was equally divided between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. He saw it in his cabinet. That's one of the reasons why in his farewell address, he warned against entangling alliances, but the other was political parties. He said that political parties were going to be the death of this democracy. And look at it today. Sure enough, that's where we're going. And the other irony is that the political party in 1860, that same Union, the Republican Party, has now become the party that's going to kill it if we continue on this current course. The Republican Party, and don't make a mistake about it, the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln and Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner in the 1860s and 70s is nowhere near the Republican Party of today. In fact, this is not even the party of Ronald Reagan, of Richard Nixon, of the Bushes. This is not their party, the Colin Powells, the Cheneys, the Liz Cheneys. It's not their party anymore. This is a new anti-democratic fascist party. It is based on anarchy. That's where it is.
Key
to any democracy is compromise.
You know, Professor Harvey, when we come back, I want you to continue that conversation about the party of today, because we thought the party of Ronald Reagan and the party of George Bush, and we thought that was bad. But what we are dealing with now,
this is
that on steroids. I got to go to a break. And we thought Liz Cheney was pretty bad off, but not today. Got to go to a break. Phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. On the line, Professor Bob Harvey, all the way from sunny Charlotte, North Carolina. What say you? You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. On the line, my good friend, Professor Bob Harvey, all the way from sunny Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, Professor Harvey, before we went to break, we were talking about the evolution of this Republican Party and conservatism. And I remember clearly the neocons and what we saw of them, the Ronald Reagan's time and George Bush's time, and we looked at those Republicans at that point in time, and we thought that they were really just some stern, cold, stony-hearted people, and yet there were still, you know, opportunities for compromise. But what we see today, Professor Harvey, is a stony-hearted people who have made it clear under Donald Trump, and some may say Donald Trump didn't really create this people that we're talking about right now, that people was always there. Donald Trump just made it okay, you know, for those people who had always been there. And the real issues with this, Professor Harvey, is this threatens to destroy this nation from the inside out. And that's how serious a time this is. And even though you see these folk who, the militias, there's always been the militias, Professor Harvey. But the difference is now the militias, were in the dark. The Posse Comitatus were up north in Wisconsin. And you didn't see them. You know, they did what they did in the dark. But what you have now is people and those people who have come out of the darkness. And they're willing to set up on corners where the FBI is located with all of their guns and their flags and threaten the nation. You say what about where we are now, Professor Harvey?
You know, we have to remember that, you know, the like I said, the seed planted to be against the federal government has always been there. You know, it's amazing with the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. Thomas Jefferson was an Anti-Federalist. He didn't believe in a strong central government. In fact, Thomas Jefferson never signed up on the Constitution because he didn't believe in it. Of course, when Jefferson got in the White House and became president for 8 years, it was all right. You know, and that's one of the things about them. They believe in a weak central government, and they attack it. Ronald Reagan was good at that, attacking the government until he got in there as president, and then all of a sudden everything is okay. And so that's one of the ironies. I mean, they have been able to push that lie all the way down through the centuries. And then once they get in power, things change. They get a little quieter. Now, you look at the issue with Donald Trump. Trump comes along, and being a businessman, he saw an opening, and he took advantage of it. And he realized that these people are angry and they're frustrated, and he fed off of their hate. That blind hatred. I mean, all of the people who go to those old rallies and get them all excited about lock her up, and making Hillary Clinton the villain. And now, you only have now a peep out of none of them about Donald Trump needs to be locked up. You know, so it's amazing how they contradict themselves. I wrote an article a few years ago. It was called A Contradiction of the Conservatives, where they contradict themselves. They push the idea of right to life, but they don't mind saturating our country with guns so that by the time you're 9 or 10 years old, you may be killed in school. They believe in the idea of the right to life, but at the same time, they're against welfare. Well, I tell you a little secret. If you bring a whole lot of unwanted children into the world, those children, and many of them, are going to end up being neglected, and they're going to end up being welfare cases, but you don't want to pay for them. And if they grow up and commit crimes, if you don't kill them, you're going to lock them up. So there's a sickness here where you don't even think through what it is you're doing because you're so full of hate and just blind hatred. And I think that, you know, that blindness, that you know, is something that, like I said, we've seen it before. But on the scale that it's at right now, it's off the charts. And that shocked me. I got the realization on in November of 2020 when I saw the election results, and I saw where 74 million people were rabid about voting for Donald Trump, an impeached president, a Confederate and congenital liar, you know, and a crook, and a wannabe dictator. But they voted for him. And if you look at the economic situation for all of those people, the chances are they didn't get a better job, they didn't get a better education, they didn't get any of the amenities that you would expect them to get. But they felt good because when they went to those rallies, Donald Trump spoke to their anger and their hatred and their frustration. And that oftentimes, Earl, is so easy to do. It's even harder to try to build a sense of peace and hope within individuals. These individuals don't want it because they have been going on for years, seething, and the Republican Party has been feeding them. Think about this. After the Civil War, In the lead up to the election of 1876 between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden, the Democrats won the election by the popular vote. But Hayes and the Republicans made a deal because they found out that in Florida, Mississippi, and one other southern state, blacks had been disenfranchised. So they made a deal. And one of the deals was to let the South handle the Negro problem. Well, that's just like having Colonel Sanders be to protect their chickens. You know what's going to happen. And the Southerners implemented their Mississippi plan, their Southern strategy of Jim Crow, and the end result was a century of abuse, lynching, murder, and disenfranchising black people at the polls. Denying them the right to vote was one of the first things that they did. And so that resentment, but they also hated the federal government. And one of the most dangerous terrorist groups that the country has ever had was, of course, groups like the Ku Klux Klan. And since that time, in the 1930s, we picked up on the neo-Nazis and groups like the skinheads, which are the newer ones now, with the neoconservative movement. Now, granted, all of those individuals that we talked about, when we talk about Goldwater, we talk about Nixon, we talk about Ford, only had 2 years, so we can't blame anything on him. Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, Daddy Bush, the son.
Professor Harvey, I need you to hold that thought. Dave, I see you. We'll get you on the other side and let you have a conversation. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.